Here's the words of our Lord Jesus Christ. Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction, and those who enter by it are many. For the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will recognize them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, do we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many mighty works in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you workers of lawlessness. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall, because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell. And great was the fall of it. And when Jesus finished these sayings, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he was teaching them as one who had authority, not as their scribes. All men are like grass, and all of our glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers and the flowers fall, but the word of God stands forever. Therefore, I think we would be wise if we gave our attention to it. Bianca and I, thanks to your generosity, went out to Denver this week for a little bit of a conference, a retreat, to learn more about church planting and pastoring. And we took one afternoon to go up into the mountains, and from where we were, we could see the Continental Divide. And the Continental Divide has always been absolutely fascinating to me because it gets snow like 60 days out of the year, and snow falls from the clouds, and it mixes, and it swirls its way down, and it lands on those mountains on the Continental Divide, and they look just alike. And no two snowflakes look alike, but you know what I mean. The snow all looks alike to us without microscopes. And they lay right next to each other. But as the spring suns hit that snow, it melts. And those, the snowflakes on the east side of the divide trickle down into tributaries and streams and ultimately into the Arkansas River, into the Mississippi River, into the Gulf of Mexico where it gets a little oil on it and then it goes out into the Atlantic Ocean. And the snowflakes lying right next to them, but they were barely on the western side of that mountain that swirled as they fell down. They melt and they turn to water, and they go into streams, into tributaries, and into the Snake River Canyon, and ultimately into the Pacific Ocean. And they were right next to each other. And they end up worlds apart. And Jesus, in this text, gives us a great preaching to the choir text, actually. He tells us, don't miss it. He says it three different times in this text. You cannot judge by externals. You cannot judge by what you do or how you look. Don't miss it. There are two kinds of people, and they're defined not by what they look like or what they do. They're defined by why they do them. And he drills his point down. That a relationship with him determines everyone's destination. He describes people who look just alike. He describes sheep and wolves dressed as sheep. He describes his friends and those who do works in his name. He describes two houses that look just alike. They experience the exact same weather. And the only difference is the foundations were completely different. That invisible foundation was completely different. And in each of these cases, the destination could not be further apart. And he asks us, don't miss it. It is not what you do, but why you do what you do. And ultimately, it is who you live for, who you do it for, that determines your destiny. And so he asks us here, why are you here? Why are you here? Are you here because this is where Jesus is to be found? Are you here because your parents made you come? Are you here because when you were much, much younger, your parents made you come, and now if you don't come, you feel like something's missing? Are you here because this is where your friends are? Are you here because you're expected to be here? Why are you here? Are you here because he's commanded you to be here, or are you here to be with Jesus? The first thing I want you to see is the two paths. Now, the problem with the Sermon on the Mount is we've heard it so much, right? And everybody knows what it means to walk the straight and narrow. If you grew up in any setting, anything like I did, and you heard testimony after testimony, you always know what it means to walk the straight and narrow. I mean, when you drank and when you were a wild man and worshiped Satan and smoked dope and ate pigs and you were crazy on the path to destruction. But you got your life cleaned up and now you're walking the straight and narrow. We all know that. And that is the understood interpretation of that text. The problem with it is it could not possibly be more wrong. It couldn't possibly be more wrong. Because Jesus is saying this as a conclusion to his sermon. You understand that, right? Typically, when you write good sermons, sometimes you don't. It's harder than it looks. But typically, when you write good sermons, you don't conclude a sermon with a completely different idea than anything you said before. Generally, if I'm preaching a sermon on children obey your parents, I don't end it with and keep your car clean. Or I don't, end it with something like, and by the way, make sure you're tithing 10%. You don't just throw in a completely different idea. You typically conclude in a way that draws everything together. And Jesus has not been speaking in his Sermon on the Mount about the difference between worldly, wild living people and good people. At nowhere in this text has he been talking about that. He has been talking about people who want to keep the law specifically and precisely, but not spiritually, versus those who want to keep the true spiritual meaning of the law. He has talked about people who give their money generously, but want to do it publicly so they can be seen, versus those who give their money secretly so only their Father in heaven can see them. He's talked about people who pray and who fast, but do it for the wrong reasons. These are not wild living people. Those wild fasters out there, stay away from them. He is talking about the difference between religious people and people who know him. And that is the difference between the two paths. It is a complete issue of change of direction. Why are you doing what you're doing? What does it mean? What is the broad and wide way? Broad and wide way leaves plenty of space. You can breathe. You're comfortable. You are able to make your own decisions. You have plenty of room to maneuver. You have plenty of room to take care of yourself. The broad path is the path where every person does what is right in his own eyes. You do what feels good. Sometimes feeling good means you feed the flesh and you eat whatever you can get your hands on, or you sleep with whoever you can get near, or you drink whatever you're thirsty for. Being in the broad path means, yeah, you feed your flesh. Sometimes being on the broad path means you feed your self-righteous pride. And you do what's going to make you feel better than other people. Sometimes being in the broad path means you follow the road of self-preservation. And so you avoid people who are doing the wild and crazy things, and you make good grades, and you go to school, and you keep an upstanding reputation because you want good jobs. And you even go to church. Sometimes being in the broad path means you go to church because you want God on your side. Because you want to keep him satisfied so he'll be nice to you. But they all lead to destruction. The broad path of doing what feels good leads to destruction. Why? Because you burn out. At some point, you just realize you can't be good enough anymore. Maybe you just feed your flesh until your flesh starts regurgitating it back. Maybe you feed that self-righteous pride until the point that you're cynical and just angry at everybody. Maybe you stay very religious for a long time, but God doesn't come through for you, and your children don't turn out the way you thought they were going to turn out, and your marriage doesn't turn out the way you thought it was going to turn out, or you just don't get married, and you were so sure you would. And you get mad at God, and you wonder why he's mad at you. And you've done all this work for him, and he's not blessed you back, and you're mad. And you still come to church because you have to, but you're mad. And you're doing it for yourself. And that is the destruction it leads to, and it is only a foretaste of the ultimate destruction that is coming. And Jesus contrasts that with a narrow path, a tight path. The word is just really means pressure, that you're surrounded, you're squeezed by it, and you pursue a single thing, a single-minded devotion. Taking the narrow path, it's like pursuing a medical degree. And your whole life, from the time you walk on the college campus, is designed to get that resume right so you can pursue that degree. And it's the only thing you see. Except in this case, he is giving us a single-minded pursuit of himself, the pursuit of a relationship. And like every pursuit of a relationship, it squeezes. You remember, for those of you who are married, you remember that feeling of pursuing a person so tight that anything that wouldn't allow you to pursue him or her was just let go of. Because you wanted that person. Every choice you make is for another. When I stand up in front of couples on their wedding day, I usually tell them something along these lines. You die today. You die today. When you take these vows, what you are promising is it is no longer acceptable for you to ever do a single thing just because you want to. From what time you get up in the morning to the type of toothpaste you use to the time, to the job that you take, to the place that you live, to the way that you dress, to the way that you, to what you eat, to the time you go to bed, every decision you make has to include another. It is never going to be acceptable again for you to just do it because you want to. That's what it means to go through a tight path. You are squeezed right out of it. The you in it is squeezed right out of it. And Jesus talks about that being the path that leads to him. You just forget about yourself altogether. You just want to be where he is. You just want to have the life that only he can give. And so you just pursue him. You don't pursue him with everything else. You just pursue him. You don't pursue him to get anything else. You just pursue him. And like every relationship with someone who loves you back, it leads to life. It's really funny. It's funny to be on this side of weddings. In college ministry, you know, we married people off and then we never saw them again. And but it's fun, more fun, I almost said funner. It's more fun to be on this side and watch the community kind of get worried about people. I would never, ever embarrass Eric and Laura if they were here, but I didn't see them this morning, so let's talk about them. They were so cute. Remember, those of you who are here, when they first got married, I mean, people were so worried about them. I remember Austin coming up to me. Man, Eric, he never goes out with us anymore. He used to always kind of go out with us. And I'm worried he's withdrawn from the community too much. And he's not getting that brotherly fellowship that he needs. And I just kind of went through marriage vows with Austin real quick. I said, you know, I think he said something about forsaking all others, and that includes you. And you know, the funny thing was, when you saw Eric those months, I don't know if you remember, you didn't see him and think, man, poor Eric. He's so sad. He's given up so much. He doesn't get to hang out with Austin anymore. You know, he had this huge, like, cat that ate the canary grin on his face. He's clearly overwhelmed with one thought alone: I get to be with Laura. That's a narrow path that leads to life. And that's what how Jesus describes the path of coming to him, that you pursue only him. And what do you get for it? You get him. You get him. And you get life. And everybody who goes through that death finds a freedom and a joy that cannot be touched. Yeah, we experience the same things. We're going to talk about that in a minute. We experience the same weather. The rain still falls. The winds still blow. The floods come up. But there's nothing valuable about you can be touched. You get pickpocketed for 50 cents, but you got millions in the bank. Because Jesus loves you. Because you have him. And that can't be touched. And so you can't be decimated. There's nothing that can destroy you. Because you have him. It seems so obvious, doesn't it? But it's not. Jesus wants us to know for sure. It is not obvious. You will not see it externally. And that's why he gives us illustrations. Two illustrations of searching for the narrow gate. The first thing he tells us is to make sure you are paying attention to who you listen to. Examine your teachers. Examine the people you are following. It's not just your pastors, but it's anybody that's exerting influence over you, the people who are disciple-making over you, the leaders in your groups. When you're together in your community group, or you're together in your group of friends, or you're together at work, you need to examine who you're listening to. Who's the leader of that group? And he says to us, they're all going to look like sheep. Universal word for Christian in the Bible, right? We're sheep. We are God's sheep, the sheep of his hand. We all look like sheep. And twice he warns us, judge them by their fruit. Now, why does he have to say it twice? Because you're not listening. I guarantee you, you are not listening. And it's sad. When you're helping people find a pastor, all they want to know, can he preach? Has he got gifts? And Jesus warns you, judge them by their fruit. What are they producing? You go into an orchard and all the trees have fruit on them. Jesus doesn't say some of them are dead. Some of them are going to have no fruit. So stay away from those. Like, we know that, right? You go to the tree that has no leaves, no fruit. That was a bad tree. We know that. He's saying they all have fruit. The problem is some of these fruit are bad. The word is actually for poison. It's poison fruit. And when we're deciding who we're going to follow and who we're going to listen to, we have to examine the kind of fruit they produce. Because he says even though they all look like sheep, some of them are actually ravenous, hungry wolves. You know what that means? It means a lot of people go into the ministry and do ministry. Are you ready for this? Because it feels good. It's really fun. It is fun to be looked up to. It is fun to be listened to. When was the last time you had a room full of 300 people listening to you. Feels good. And a lot of people go into the ministry for that feeling. It just feels good. We all get blinded by it. And you want more, and you want influence, and you start getting quoted. And man, it feels good to get quoted. Sometimes you get quoted back to yourself, and the person doesn't even know they're quoting you back. It feels good. And you got to be careful of that feeling. You got to be careful of people who go into the ministry to feed themselves off of the sheep. In worst cases, that leads to adultery, or in worst cases, that leads to greed. People just in the ministry to get money because they know that you love them and you'll give them your money. But much more often, it simply means that we want to feel good. We want to have people listen to us. So how do you discern? How do you discern false prophets? That's a sermon you won't hear real often, I'm telling you right now. I'm stuck, right? I either have to make myself look good or bad right here, right? And I'm not going to call myself a false prophet, newsflash. So I'm going to try to be as generic as I can, and I encourage you to be extremely careful as you're deciding who to follow. And the first thing you judge by is the fruit of the ministry. Are people being converted? Are the people who are converted, I thought about this a lot as I was writing this sermon. I think a dangerous temptation for a false prophet is to love the story of a dramatic conversion. But if you'll notice, you never see those people who are getting dramatically converted coming around. They're never in the community. They never actually make it to growth. So look at the fruits of their ministry. Are people growing in holiness? Are people getting into the ministry? Are they making disciples who make disciples? Secondly, look for the fruit of personal holiness. Do they have humility of spirit? Can you correct them easily? This conference I went to this weekend, the first speaker was talking about training up disciples, and he used this example that I thought was amazing. While he had this kind of small Bible study, about four guys in his house, his wife came in to serve dinner, and he basically just blew his wife off. So not now, you know, we're meeting. Gave the huge, you know, Heisman Trophy. We're too important for you. And he talked to his wife later, and he apologized. He really, you know, he did, I think, a true gospel apology. But his next meeting with those guys, he said, before we get into the topic, I want to know what y'all thought about how I treated my wife. And he opened the door. He teed the ball up for them, he said. He said, I wanted them to rebuke me. They needed to rebuke me. And I invited that. And I just thought, that is a beautiful example of a godly minister. He's humble of spirit. You know his sins. The Apostle Paul asks us, are your elders above reproach? Above reproach. You can't even think of something to accuse them of. Of good reputation in the community. Not accusable. The Apostle Paul goes on to talk about familial holiness. You're trying to judge a pastor. You're trying to decide whether to call someone. Decide whether to listen to someone. Decide whether to follow someone. Guys, all you have to do is ask your wife, would you want to be treated like his wife is treated? And if the answer to that is no, then flee to the hills. Do you want your children to act the way his children act? Do you want to emulate him in familial holiness? That's what the Apostle Paul says to judge a minister by. Be careful of false prophets. It's not easy to see. We want to listen to their arguments. We want to listen to their words, and we want to judge them by their words. And they want to be judged by their words. I was in the classroom upstairs where they teach debate, and they're talking about fallacies. There's a list of fallacies on the wall, and one of them is the ad hominem fallacy, which is to say that someone's argument is illegitimate because they're a bad person. And in debate, that's bad. Don't do that. Happens a lot. Well, you're bad. You're a bad person, so I don't listen to you. Don't listen to that. That's bad argumentation. But when it comes to following a minister, it is exactly the right thing to do. Because doctrine produces character. Do you want to be like that character? Examine your teachers, Jesus says. Examine your confidence, Jesus says. He asks us, what will you say when you see Jesus as the judge? He says, many. Many will come to me. And they're not self-righteous jerks, and we hate those people. They're passionate. Lord, Lord. They say it twice for emphasis. The same way Jesus looked at Martha and said, Martha, Martha. The same way Jesus looked at Mary at the tomb of Lazarus and said, Mary, Mary. They say it with passion for emphasis. They have the right doctrine. They say, Jesus, didn't we not do this in your name? These aren't people serving the Lord in the name of Allah. These are people of action who teach the word, who cast out demons, whose have lives changed under them. And Jesus declares to them, you are workers of lawlessness because I never knew you. Why were they doing these things? The only possible way they could be workers of lawlessness is if they were not doing these things under the first commandment. They were not loving the Lord in their works. They were doing these things for themselves. You see, this is the problem with Christianity. It's the problem with preaching the gospel. I listened to this talk about hell in the car the other day and how hell is such a useful tool to get people to become Christians. It makes sense, right? Become a Christian, you don't want to go to hell. It's worked for years. The problem is this. If you become a Christian to avoid going to hell, you're still not a Christian. Why? Because you've done it for yourself. That's still self-interest. Christianity is about getting as far away from self-interest as you can. So it has to be more than that. It's about a person. And Jesus tells us it's not about how far down the path you go. It's about which path you're on. Are you serving yourself? Or are you following after me? And you see, judgment has to be done that way. If the judgment day were an issue of works, well, that's unfair. Because he hasn't told us how many works we got to do. Right? I mean, all judgments based on works feel unfair. At Union, they have this thing called the Pride Card. And you have to have all B's to get a Pride Card. And if you have it, you can sit wherever you want to in the cafeteria. And so one of my sons got his mid-semester grade card. And these were his grades. I'm not making this up. 98, 97, 179. No Pride Card for him. Other kids got 80, 80, 80, 81, Pride Card. One test. It just feels unfair, right? Well, you know, big deal. He didn't get to sit where he wanted to in the cafeteria. But you have to have rules. That's the way it is. But what if the decision weren't about where to sit in the cafeteria? What if it was about eternal hell? How fair would that be? Sorry, 79. You know, Jesus, you didn't even tell me how many times I had to go to church. How was I supposed to know? I mean, how many times can I use the Lord's name in vain? I think I'm pretty high on that list. I need to know. It's not fair. If he all of a sudden just kind of brings out this standard and says, sorry, you didn't mean it. But he says that that's not what the judgment is based on. It is based upon a person. A completely different path. Did you do this for me or not? Was your obedience for me or for yourself? Were you trying to twist my arm to give you things? Or did you love me? Did you know me? Were you seeking me? Were you seeking a good life? Were you seeking to avoid hell? Were you seeking something from me? Or were you seeking me? If you're seeking me, that's all that matters. Because I'm ultimately the one who will save you. And this final illustration, the story of two houses. You have two builders build, we're to assume, similar houses. They look just alike. But one is just doing the stuff. And it builds it on the foundation of sand. It's invisible. I mean, when was the last time you went over to a friend's house and said, oh, this dining room's nice, but show me the foundation. You don't see it. And the two houses experience the same weather. The rain still falls. The wind still blows. The floods still come. But he tells us if the house is built on the rock, on his word, then it stands. And if the house collapses, if the house is built on serving self, then it falls and it collapses. And I really do think that is an important thing for us to understand. Everybody's going to have the rain fall. Everybody's going to have the wind blow. And if the hard things of life, if the struggles of life, if the suffering of life causes your religion to collapse, if that causes your Christianity to collapse, then that really ultimately should show you that the only reason you were a Christian to begin with was to avoid the floods. You were just trying to avoid the rain. You weren't pursuing Jesus. But if you build your house on the rock, what a beautiful promise. It will not fall. So Jesus asks us here at the end of his sermon, what is our foundation? What are you really trusting? What are you pursuing? Now, I don't know what you're thinking about right now. Hopefully you're either thinking about lunch or the sermon. Those are the only two options. But tomorrow, Tuesday, Wednesday, when you go to bed Thursday night, what are you pursuing? What is your foundation? Do you really think a marriage is going to survive? Is it going to deliver you? Do you really think that you're getting the right job and pursuing it is going to protect you against the floods of life? Really? The economy is that stable? Do you really think that your financial plan is going to provide ultimate stability? Really? Do you really think that if you can just get your son to practice hard enough, he'll get a financial scholarship or a college scholarship, and that's going to deliver his soul and protect him from all forms of evil? Really? Do you really think if you can just get your daughter educated enough, and she'll be safe? You really think that's a house that will stand? Do you really think if you come to church enough times, you'll be good enough and it will stand? Jesus throughout is teaching us that only a relationship with him, only knowing him will stand. The narrow place leads to life because he was crushed for our iniquities. Knowing him means we'll never be told to depart and cast out, because God told him to depart and forsook him. Knowing him means that we will weather the storm without collapse, because he weathered the storm of God's wrath for us. And we know he will stand. Know him. Pursue him. Let's take a few moments to examine ourselves and then we'll pray.